All flights out of the Sol system passed through the broadcast station orbiting Mars. We had barely cleared the atmosphere when the prepare for jump sign flashed over the passenger compartment. Tent shields formed over the windows, but they only muffled the glare shining off the two gigantic elliptical disks that formed the broadcast station. The disks looked like giant mirrors. They were more than 1 mile across. Ships did not enter the disks. They merely approached and lowered their shields. The jagged electrical stream pouring out of the mirrors was so bright that glancing at it could blind you for life. The pilots cut the engines as we approached the broadcast disks. Our ship slowed to a glide while a silvery red laser scanned the outside of the ship, verifying our registration and checking for hazardous substances and weapons. Then the sending disk, the one that translated ships into impulses and transmitted them, splashed its blue-white lightning against our hull. Then we were flashed into the Sagittarius arm. It took us 5 minutes to travel the 500 miles from the surface of Mars to the broadcast disks, and less than 1 second to travel nearly 10,000 light years to the Sagittarius arm. My trip from the Sagittarius arm to the Scutum Crux arm took less than 5 seconds. Using the broadcast corridor, you could travel from one galactic arm to the next in a matter of moments. Traveling within that arm to your final destination could take weeks. The network did not rely on wormholes or black holes or any other natural phenomenon. It was purely devised by man. Sending disks emitted some kind of energy wave that absorbed matter and waves as they approached. The disk would simply communicate everything it translated to a receiving disk, where it could be turned back into its original form. Our final jump placed us in the center of Scutum Crux, a mere 500 million miles from command headquarters. Once away from the disks, most military vehicles were required to travel at a standard 30 million miles per hour. That meant approximately 17 hours of flying time. Most of the other passengers on the ship were officers who chatted quietly among themselves. With nothing better to do, I decided to follow Alec Oberlin's advice and browsed the latest news broadcasts. I clipped on a pair of MediaLink shades and tapped the power button beside the right lens. MediaLinks let you browse the news, send letters, or place calls. They were the basis of civilian communications, but their signal could not be secured. Enemies could tape them or jam them in combat. The shades worked very much like the visual controls in my combat helmet. Selecting topics and scrolling through menus by twitching my eye, I began searching for the Senate hearings that Oberlin told me about. I selected the News and Information option rather than Entertainment Programming or Correspondence. A menu appeared offering Pangalactic Highlights, Local News, Sports, Entertainment News, and Business. I chose local news for Scutum Crux. Two newscasters discussed big stories around Scutum Crux. The first story involved a planet called Ezer Cree sending a delegation to Washington to meet with the Senate.
The people of Ezer Cree have long been debating changing the name of their planet. After an election held yesterday, the majority vote fell to the name Shin Nippon. Shin Nippon is Japanese for New Japan. However, when the governor of Ezer Cree notified the Senate, he was informed that the change was out of the question. The governor and the delegation of Ezer Cree politicians were summoned to D.C. to discuss the matter before the Senate.
No arrests, no rebellion. Why had this seemed important to Oberlin? I paused the broadcast. Though I had never heard of Ezer Cree, I remember hearing something about a colony of Japanese people refusing to integrate. The rumors did not mean anything to me when I first heard them, but there must have been more to it. I scanned ahead. When the Unified Authority first settled Ezer Cree, I'm not sure what the name Ezer referred to, but Cree was a notation used for planets that had engineered atmospheres. In 2303, the planetary administrator was of Japanese ancestry. Working quietly, he appointed several people of similar descent to his cabinet. When the administrator retired, he appointed his own successor. Not surprisingly, the new administrator was Japanese. Over the next 200 years, there was a Japanese migration to Ezer Cree. While the rest of the galaxy integrated, 35% of the population of Ezer Cree was Japanese. The non-Japanese population complained about discrimination, but a UA investigation found that Ezer Cree was productive and law-abiding, a model planet with an excellent educational system and one of the best economies in the Republic. For some reason, Oberlin equated the proposed name change with sedition. So did the Senate, apparently. It meant nothing to me, and trying to reason it out gave me a headache. I switched off my media shades and went to sleep. Including stops at several space stations, the trip took nearly 20 hours.
We're coming up on the Kamehameha.
Hearing the announcement, I looked out my window. All I saw was an endless field of stars. The corporal in the row across the aisle woke up and stretched.
You see a pale gray star at 1 o'clock?
The Kamehameha was a pasty gray dot.
See it?
Flat-colored speck? It looks pretty small.
It gets bigger.
It did indeed. As we approached, the batwing shape of the hull seemed to stretch for miles. The Kamehameha grew larger by the moment. Soon I could see blue and white plumes flaring from its giant engines. We might still have been 50 miles away when we slowed to approaching speed, but the old fighter carrier already looked considerably larger than the transport in which I had traveled. Another minute passed, and I could make out the individual gun placements.
It's huge.
First time on a carrier?
Yes.
It gets a lot bigger.
Again, he was correct. I lost sight of the ship as we circled it from above to make our final approach. When we came around, we were less than 100 yards from the rear of the ship. Our pilot adjusted his approach, and we coasted onto a landing dock in the terraced rear of the ship.
You won't even know you're on a ship. It's not like being on a transport or a frigate. You won't feel it move or hear the engines. It's like living on base.
The corporal looked like a freshly minted clone. He had the stubble-cut hair of a young cadet, but the small scars on his face and neck suggested he'd seen action. Military clones were a squat and powerful breed, standing just shy of 6 feet tall. This man, however, clearly a bodybuilder, was wider than most. His shoulders and packed arms were not government issue.
You must have spent a lot of time at your last assignment. I've never met a corporal with less than 2 years' time on a carrier. This is my third, and I was lucky. I made corporal in 5 years.
Deckhands opened the hatch from outside the transport, and the officers at the front of the cabin filed out.
Unless I miss my guess, we'll probably end up in the same platoon. I'm Vince Lee, just transferred up from Outer Scrotum.
From where?
The Outer Scrotum Crux Fleet.
Wason Harris.
I stood up and pulled my gear from the locker above my seat. I followed Lee off the transport and into a large receiving area. Two officers, a young Marine captain and a slightly older naval commander, stood on deck. The other passengers had already grouped by branch by the time we stepped down the ramp. Lee and I took our spots at the head of the Marines. The captain stepped forward.
At ease. I'm Captain Galen McKay.
From the side of my eye, I watched a group of pilots vanish down a gleaming hallway. I did not see so much as a finger smudge on the walls. Every light in every ceiling fixture shone brightly, and the floors sparkled. Captain McKay looked as if he had been polished, too. He was small for a Marine, certainly no more than 5 feet 6 inches tall, with a wiry build. A strip of blonde stubble covered the top of his head, and the sides were shaved clean. He had more of a smirk than a smile, but I liked the informal way in which he appraised us.
I'll take you to your quarters.
We followed McKay down the hall.
You boys are lucky. Marines get a good shake in this fleet. Admiral Kleiber doesn't play favorites with pilots and sailors. Sea Soldier Chow is as good as any on this ship.
McKay led us to a series of cabins in which bunk beds lined the walls. McKay sent men to various barracks. Then he came to Lee and me.
Let's talk in my office. Harris, I'll start with you.
He led me through an empty barrack.
Throw your bags on any rack.
I dropped my bags on the nearest bunk.
Is your gear in working order, Corporal?
No, sir. The interlink is out in my helmet.
That was a side effect of Freeman's chemical blast back on Gobi.
Bring it along, Harris.
We entered a small office.
Take a seat, Corporal. We're starting up a new platoon. Your sergeant arrives tomorrow. He's transferring in from the Inner SC fleet. Admiral Kleiber believes that something is going to break loose in Outer Scrotum Crux.
McKay picked up my personnel file and began reading.
Yes, I remember your record. You were the one who made corporal in 3 months. Must be some kind of a record. Exactly what sort of meritorious service did you perform on Gobi?
Terrorists attacked our outpost, sir.
Attacked an outpost? Were you working out of an embassy?
No, sir.
You mentioned a problem with your helmet.
Yes, sir. My interlink equipment failed during the battle.
I don't know who designed this ship, but you can always count on something breaking when you need it most. My visor went black during a firefight, and I nearly shot my commanding officer. Look, around here you turn your headgear in for routine maintenance after every battle. Fleet policy. We take maintenance seriously in this fleet. Show up for an engagement with a broken helmet, and you'll be lucky if the enemy gets you before I do. You got that, Corporal?
Yes, sir.
You can bring your helmet back from battles melted to your head if you like. That's your business. But show up with broken gear, and I'll send you to the brig.
Yes, sir.
And Corporal, in case you have not guessed, Showing up to new assignments with busted gear makes a bad first impression.
Yes, sir.
Leave the helmet. I'll requisition repairs. You've been assigned to the flagship of the Outer SC Fleet, Corporal. We don't put up with sloppiness on this ship.
McKay handed me a 3-inch stack of papers.
Get this read ASAP. That will be all.
Until Amos Crowley's visit, the UA Marines maintained Gobi Station with 41 men, one man shy of a full platoon. The bowels of the Kamehameha housed two full divisions of Marines, over 2,300 of the Republic's finest. Bryce Kleiber's authority extended beyond the ship and even the fleet. Every unit in the Scutum Crux arm was under his command. He was the only officer in the UA Navy to hold the rank of Fleet Admiral, a rank generally reserved for wartime. Captain Thaddeus Oliveira commanded the Kamehameha, and Vice Admiral Absalom Barry commanded the Outer Scutum Crux fleet. Kleiber, who I soon learned was a notorious micro-commander, preferred to work out of an office on the ship so that he could observe operations firsthand. The documentation McKay gave me described the protocol and command structure of the Outer SC fleet. Most of the information was standard procedure, but I needed to relearn standard procedures and chain of command after 3 months on Gobi. Judging by the way Kleiber ran the Scutum Crux territories, he was the kind of commander who required his subordinates to march to his own drum. As a young Marine, I did not know much about Navy workings. It struck me as odd that Kleiber, supposedly a powerful admiral, retained an old ship like the Kamehameha for his flagship. The Kamehameha might have worked well as Kleiber's movable command post, but it was obsolete as a fighter carrier. Kleiber built each of his three fleets around a core of 12 fighter carriers. The Kamehameha was an old expansion-class carrier, the only carrier of its class that was still in operation. All of the other carriers were Perseus class, a newer breed of brute measuring 4,500 feet long and almost 5,100 feet wide. Perseus class carriers bore a complement of 11,000 Marines, five times the fighting force that traveled on the Kamehameha. Perseus class carriers stowed three times more tanks, transports, gunships, and fighters than expansion class carriers and had much quicker means for deploying units. Lee and I spent our first night in half-empty barracks. 10 of the men assigned to our platoon had trickled in throughout the day, but most of the racks remained empty. Huddled in my bunk, I quietly read Scutum Crux fleet documentation well into the sleep period.
Harris, you're a long, long way from Gobi.
Lee was laid out on the bunk next to mine.
Wason, what are you doing?
Reading regs. You finished reading already?
I don't need to read them. We had the exact same regulations at my last post. I was already under Kleiber's command.
I think I'm still on Earth time.
I'm having trouble sleeping myself. Tell you what, you want to go have a look around the ship?
We can do that.
Damn, Harris, you're not in boot camp. Nobody cares what corporals do after hours.
Boot camp wasn't that long ago. After basic, I got sent to a planet called Gobi. Regulations didn't matter much there. I don't want to screw up.
Okay. On behalf of Fleet Admiral Kleiber, I formally give you permission to climb out of your bunk. You may grab a bite to eat, visit the bar, or have a look around the ship. Just keep out of restricted areas.
We got dressed and slipped out of the barracks. The ship had an eerie, abandoned feel to it. Our barracks and training areas were located amidships on one of the lower decks of the Kamehameha, not all that far from the docking bay. In the time that I had been on board, I had only seen the landing bay, the barracks, and the mess area. Lee, who had never served aboard that particular ship but had a working knowledge of carriers, had no problem conducting an impromptu tour. We passed armories, a library, and file rooms, all populated with skeleton crews. At 3 a.m, even the bars sat empty. We went up 3 floors to the crew area.
This area is not restricted, but don't expect to spend much time up here. Sailors think of us as cargo.
It hadn't taken me long to strike up a friendship with Lee. Like the clones back in Orphanage 553, Lee had created his own kind of personality. He did not know he was a clone, of course, and he thought one day he might be bootstrapped into the ranks of the officers. From there, he wanted to enter politics. Unlike our barracks, the crew area showed signs of life. Duty officers patrolled the halls. We passed a mess area that smelled of fried eggs and meat. I peered in the door and saw sailors hunched over trays. A little farther, we passed a rec room with game tables, card tables, and a bar. At that early hour, the recreation center sat empty and dark, but I could imagine it filled with lights and sounds and people during the early evening.
They have a movie theater in there. I'll bet my next paycheck that our rec doesn't have a theater.
That's a good way to go bankrupt. Congress spares no expense when it comes to keeping its Marines entertained.
You boys looking for something?
We turned around as a sailor approached us.
We're new on the ship, just having a look around.
Yeah, you must be new. This here is the crew area. We stow Marines below.
Didn't mean to intrude.
We turned back to the elevator.
Not very hospitable. Thought we were all fighting on the same side. Speck and clone.
I had only met Vince Lee earlier that day when he and I went to explore the Kamehameha, so I did not notice the anomaly then. With time, I would notice that though he was friendly and outgoing with me, Lee did not socialize with the other men in our platoon. He and I normally found a table off on our own. No enlisted man saw himself as a clone, though most of them were indeed just that. Even so, anti-syntheticism was rare among clones because they were raised with other clones, and the only people they knew growing up were clones. They did not know how to associate with natural-born people. But Lee? Lee was different. Like so many UA citizens, Vince Lee was quietly prejudiced against clones. He thought clones were beneath him. The difference was that other people were natural-born. Vince was synthetic. Many officers were anti-synthetic. They despised their underlings. Vince was different. He despised his own kind. The rest of the platoon arrived the following afternoon. That included our new sergeant, Tabor Shannon. As Vince might have put it, life aboard the Kamehameha became less hospitable the moment Shannon arrived. Master Gunnery Sergeant Tabor Shannon landed on a late afternoon shuttle. Shannon was the personification of the word paradox. He was gruff, ruthless, and often profane. He openly favored the men who transferred in with him and even referred to them as my men because they came with him from his previous platoon. He was a belligerent and battle-hardened Marine. Captain McKay sent Lee and me to meet Shannon and the other men at the landing bay.
I bet he's a prick. What do you want to bet he's a real prick among men?
We watched several officers disembark. Shannon came next. He was tall and thin, with steep shoulders and a wiry frame. His fine white hair, the hair of an old man, did not match his sunburnt face. Except for crow's feet and white hair, he looked like a 30-year-old.
12th Platoon, you part of my outfit?
When we nodded, he dropped his bags at our feet.
Stow these on my rack.
Under other circumstances, that kind of arrogance pissed me off. But I had noticed something about Shannon's bags that left me too stunned to care. Lee saw it too. The letters GCF were stenciled large and red on the side of the bag. When I was growing up, every kid in the orphanage knew what those letters stood for. Galactic Central Fleet. That was a name with a dark history.
You don't think he's a liberator?
Damn, I heard they were all dead.
The truth was that I did not know much about the Galactic Central Fleet or the special strain of clones that were created to fight in it. The history books called them liberators. But that was mostly because calling them butchers seemed disrespectful. The government deemed the battles in the Galactic Central War classified information and never released accounts of what took place. But the government could not classify the events that led up to war. Unified Authority ships began prospecting the eye of the galaxy, the nexus where the various arms of the Milky Way meet in a spiral, about 40 years ago. That was during the height of the expansion. We had long suspected that we had the galaxy to ourselves, and exploration into the farthest and deepest corners of the frontier only increased the belief that the universe belonged to mankind. By this time, we had traveled to the edge of the Milky Way, but not to the center. The media covered every detail of that first expedition to the center of the galaxy, including its disastrous ending. 5 self-broadcasting Pioneer-class vessels were sent. All 5 disappeared upon arrival in the galactic eye. There was no information about what happened to the ships. Some people speculated that radiation or possibly some unknown element destroyed them as they emerged from their broadcast. The most common theory, of course, was that the expedition was attacked. But whatever really became of those ships happened so quickly that no information was relayed back to Earth. If the politicians and military types knew more than the general public, they did not let on. Congress went into an emergency session and commissioned a special fleet to investigate, the Galactic Central Fleet, the largest and most well-armed fleet in UA naval history. The hearings and the creation of the Galactic Central Fleet were matters of public record. Reporters were taken out to the shipyards where the fleet's 200 cruisers, 200 destroyers, and 180 battleships were under construction. It took 3 years to build the fleet. During that time, the entire Republic braced for an alien attack. Once the fleet was constructed, however, the news accounts stopped. This much I knew, that the Galactic Central Fleet was launched on February 5th, 2455, and that it vanished. The ships were sent to the Galactic Eye and never heard from again. To avoid increased panic, The government imposed a news blackout immediately after the fleet disappeared. Then, 2 months after the disappearance, the Senate announced that the Galactic Corps was under UA control. The only historical record of the event was a statement from the Secretary of the Navy stating that a battery of specially trained soldiers conquered Ground Zero. Sometime after that, a congressional panel announced that the men in the GC regiment were an experimental class of clones known only as Liberators. There were no pictures of Liberator clones in our history texts, and though I searched, I never found any pictures on the media link, nor did I ever find any information about the aliens that the Liberator clones fought in the Galactic Eye.
The bag says GCF. You don't think he could be a Liberator?
You?
I don't know. I had a teacher who served with some Liberators. He said that they were taller and slimmer than other clones. He also said that they massacred entire planets.
One of my teachers said that they enjoyed killing people, and that they killed civilians when they ran out of enemy soldiers. That must have been an old rucksack. He didn't look much older than us.
Shannon was clearly a clone. A different species of clone, but still a clone. He had the same dark features as Lee, though he was a few inches taller. They looked like brothers.
Like seeing a ghost.
Having heard all kinds of rumors about Liberators in the orphanage, I should not have been surprised that Shannon looked so young. Liberators were supposed to have a synthetic gene that kept them young.
We'd better stow his stuff. I would hate to piss him off.
Lee was too late. Just about everything pissed Shannon off. He marched into the barracks like a one-man wrecking crew.
What is your name, Private? Private First Class Christopher Charla, sir. Did the Congress of the Unified Authority award you that bunk, PFC Charla?
No.
I did not hear you, Charla. What did you say to me?
No, Sergeant!
Then this rack does not belong to you. Is that correct, Charla?
Yes, Sergeant!
Sergeant Shannon turned to look at Lee and me.
I told you to stow these bags in my office! Then set up your racks! You sleep over there!
He pointed to the farthest bunks from his office, and I realized that he had just demoted us to the bottom of the platoon. My situation became worse the following morning. Still unable to adjust to Scutum Crux time, I woke up at 0500 and fidgeted in my bunk until I was sure I could not fall back to sleep. I put on my Media Link shades to see if Ezer Cree was still in the news.
Ezer Cree, a crisis in the making. The Ezer Cree delegation has asked the Linear Committee for a new senator. They want to hold a planet-wide election and choose their senator by popular vote, the same way they elected their member of the House. Nearly every elected official on Ezer Cree is of Japanese descent. Though not stating it outright, the members of the committee seem to want to excise everything Japanese from the planet. The request has been refused on the account of it being unconstitutional. Yoshi Yamashiro, the governor of Ezer Cree, and the head of the delegation next resubmitted a petition asking for permission to change the name of his planet from Ezer Cree to Shin Nippon. The chairman of the Linear Committee pointed out that Shin Nippon meant New Japan and refused to consider the petition.
At this point, the story switched to video footage shot in the committee chambers.
Mr. Chairman, we ask that the official language of Ezer Cree be changed to Japanese. That is a language spoken by a plurality of our population.
Governor Yamashiro, I will not entertain such a request. You are entirely out of bounds. Your behavior signifies contempt for this body.
I apologize for my offense, Mr. Chairman. I humbly suggest that you change the name of the Republic to the Unified Singular Authority.
The picture of the hearing faded, and my shades now showed three analysts sitting around a table.
This was footage of the Ezer Cree delegation's meeting with the Linear Committee this morning. After having several requests denied, Governor Yoshi Yamashiro suggested that the Unified Authority be renamed the Unified Singular Authority. As you can see, the reaction was swift and angry.
Jane, that reaction was to Yamashiro's veiled suggestion that the government is really an extension of the old United States. The point of his comment was that we should take on the initials USA. Yamashiro made some good points. The Linear Committee has been openly antagonistic toward the Ezer Cree delegation. We're not talking about a planet trying to break from the Republic, for God's sake. They just want to rename their planet.
It's not just the planet name.
There are already planets named Athens, Columbia, Jerusalem.
Those are city names, and they do not have majority populations of Greek or Israeli descent. It's not just the name, it's the language. Governor Yamashiro wants to speak an entirely different language than the rest of the Republic.
Jane, when was the last time you watched a broadcast from outside the Orion Arm? By the end of the century, linguistic scholars predict the dialects spoken in the outer arms will have evolved into unique languages. You cannot expect people who live 10,000 light years apart to go on speaking the same language forever.
And you think switching from English to Japanese is part of that evolution?
What I find most disturbing is the paranoia that is surrounding this entire issue. It's as if the committee believes that switching the language is the first step to an invasion. It's ridiculous.
By that time, I was losing interest in the story, so I switched off my shades. When I removed my shades, I saw a message light blinking over my bunk. Sergeant Shannon wanted me to come to his office. Shannon was not in his office when I arrived. I found my helmet waiting on his desk. Lee, just back from the gym, came into the barracks as I was stowing my helmet.
Hey, how was your workout?
Fine.
As we walked toward the mess area, I saw a strangely familiar sight on some of the monitors along the hall. A picture of General Amos Crowley bent over a stack of poker chips, holding a particle beam pistol.
Enemy of the Republic. Former general and noted terrorist Amos Crowley stands accused of sedition, rebellion, and murder. Son of a bitch.
Do you know him?
I think I took that photograph.
You don't know if you took it?
I was at that card game, but I didn't have a camera. Neither did anybody else.
Somebody had one. Do you play cards with traitors on a regular basis?
And then it struck me. All those gadgets packed into our visors. Polarizing lenses, telescopic lenses, communications systems. Add a little data storage, and you could record everything.
Do our visors record data?
Sure. How long have you been... You wore your helmet to a card game? Harris, you're all right.
Glad I've got your seal of approval.
That's not your sidearm, is it?
No, it's not.
Just asking. Whose is it?
It belonged to a guy named Taj Gutman.
He wagered his firearm? I bet he wasn't wearing his helmet.
No, he wasn't.
His goose is fried.
Not many of my memories are associated with a particular day of the week, but I have no trouble recalling what day my helmet was returned to me. It was on a Sunday. I know that because later that day, hoping to get away from all of the questions about Crowley and the card game, I went to the rec room to watch a movie. Sincerely wanting to be alone, I chose the emptiest route through the Marine compound, and that took me by the chapel. Nobody went anywhere near that area on Sunday. The military was always trying to push religion, but in my experience, fear of God was one of the things that science never managed to build into its neural programming. Many of the officers attended church services, but none of the clones I knew believed in God. As I passed by the open door of the chapel on this day, however, I happened to catch a glance at somebody sitting alone at the rear of the chapel. His back was to me, but the tall, wiry frame and fine, white old man's hair were unmistakable. There, wearing his dress uniform, was Sergeant Shannon. Swearing, bullying, belligerent Sergeant Shannon. Some people say that the most glorious sight they ever saw was a beautiful moon or a perfect sunrise. For me, it was the three fleets of the Scutum Crux Arm converging in orbit over Terra No. Each fleet was set in array with its 12 Perseus-class fighter carriers set in a row like the jagged teeth of an enormous saw. Frigates and transports, awesome ships in their own right, seemed insignificant beside the mighty bulk of these dreadnoughts. The massive shadow of the fleets cast a discernible outline on the watery surface of the planet below.
The UA Navy is awesome.
I spent some time stationed on Nebraska Minor.
Vince leaned against a guardrail.
Ever heard of Nebraska Minor?
I cannot say that I have.
They do a lot of farming there.
Exciting assignment.
People on Nebraska Minor used to say, you should always kill the pig before you eat it. You ever heard that before?
I feel deprived. On Gobi we had sayings like, you should never eat your children after they are 6 years old.
It's a big fleet. A lot of firepower. Greece and Rome weren't able to hold on to Europe. How can we possibly hope to control a whole galaxy? If there are planets that want out of the Republic, Wason, I'm not sure we should force them to stay in.
I don't see how they can stand up to a fleet like this.
What happened on Gobi? Crowley attacked a Marine base?
You after the blow-by-blow?
Vince nodded, and I told him the whole story, including the part about becoming a corporal in 3 months. I think the promotion was the part that embarrassed me the most.
The Unified Authority has long provided safety and prosperity for its member states. Now it has come to our attention that certain factions wish to divide our republic. These terrorists would destroy the fabric of our society to satisfy their own selfish needs. Though their insurrection poses no significant threat to our great republic, it must be dealt with.
I noticed two things about Fleet Admiral Bryce Kleiber as I watched his high-definition image on the three-dimensional screen. His nearly starved physique and his overwhelming intensity. Kleiber's cheekbones stuck out like ridges across his chiseled face, and his skull looked dented at the temples. He had long arms that reminded me of twigs. The overall impression was that you could snap the man over your knee like a stick. However, I soon found myself mesmerized by the intensity in his icy blue eyes. He stared into the camera, seldom blinking as he plowed through his speech.
In future years, historians will look back upon the Unified Authority as one of man's crowning achievements. As a nation, we have conquered space. We have conquered the galaxy. Our progress will not be slowed by a band of hooligans.
Yeah!
Hooligans!
Yeah, go you way!
That's right, Kleiber!
Speck yeah, Kleiber!
I have spoken with both the Joint Chiefs and the Linear Committee, and they have authorized me to subdue the enemy by all means necessary. As we speak, enemy strongholds are being targeted in all six galactic arms, and terrorist leaders are being sought out.
The platoon watched Kleiber's speech on a small monitor hanging from the ceiling of our barracks. Everyone around me fidgeted with excitement, except Shannon, who stood mute and slack-jawed with an expression that betrayed no emotion.
I will not discuss our tactics at this time, but every officer will be briefed. The details and goals of our missions will become apparent over the next few days. Dismissed.
What do you think?
Sounds like war. We will overwhelm them.
If we can find them.
By the time Vince and I went to the Sea Soldiers bar late that afternoon, it was already packed with non-coms.
You find them. I'll get the beer.
It took a few minutes to fight through the crowd to get a couple of beers and find the table. I handed Vince his beer.
Earth-grown malt? I thought you didn't taste any difference.
I don't. You've sprung for Earth-grown so many times I felt guilty.
Most of our platoon sat around this table in two nearly concentric circles.
Guess we're standing.
Have you guys heard anything?
You kidding? Corporals are always the last to hear shit.
Just across from me, Sergeant Shannon sat with one leg up on the table. He looked relaxed, and his smile was almost friendly.
We'll all know soon enough.
The banter continued. We no longer seemed like a divided platoon. Shannon leaned back in his chair and listened to the conversations around him.
Harris!
Captain McKay tapped me on the shoulder.
Harris, I suspect that you're just about the most important person in the fleet right now.
Begging your pardon, sir? I don't understand.
That an Earth-grown brew you're drinking? The record from your helmet. That was the key to all of this. I showed it to Kleiber, and he showed it to the Linear Committee. Do you know what Admiral Kleiber told the committee? He told them that our enemies no longer fear us. No longer fear us. That was what finally woke them up. That and your video feed. Life in this galaxy just got a little more exciting thanks to that goddamn helmet of yours.
I'm not sure what to say.
Sergeant Shannon called Lee and me into his office the next day.
We have our orders. Have a seat. The Kamehameha has been assigned to a planet called Ezer Cree. Never heard of it?
No, Sergeant.
We're invading Ezer Cree? Ezer Cree has been in the news. I've been following the story.
You know about Ezer Cree?
The story's all over the news. Ezer Cree has a large population of ethnically pure Japanese people who want to make Japanese the official language of the planet. The governor of the planet went to D.C. and the Linear Committee said no.
Japanese? There's got to be something more. You can't invade a planet just because a bunch of people want to speak Japanese.
I thought the old races disappeared.
You run into it a bit out here. I've never seen an entire planet like that.
So we're sending a fleet? Are we going to blockade the planet or something?
I don't know what Kleiber has in mind. He's sending the Kamehameha and a few support ships.
Is Admiral Kleiber coming along for the ride?
I don't know if he returned to ship after Terrano. We're still 6 days out from Ezer Cree. Harris, see that every man in the platoon gets his armor shined and ready.
Yes.
You should be keen on maintenance, considering all the trouble your faulty helmet has caused. One other thing. I worked you both over when I got here. The whole deal changes now that we have an assignment. You understand? I'll be dependent on you.
Yes.
Understood.
The rain streamed down in sheets. Sudden gusts of wind slammed into the sides of the armored transport, battering it off course. We called the cabin area of armored transports the Kettle because it was metal, pot-bellied, and had no windows. The transport swayed as it touched down. Then the rear of the ship split open, revealing a ramp for us to disembark. We had arrived. They packed both of Captain McKay's platoons into one transport, 60 privates, 16 corporals, and 6 sergeants. We came wearing armor and carrying minimal field supplies. Shannon, his M27 braced across his chest as if he expected resistance, charged down the ramp and vanished into the glare of the landing lights. We had touched down on a temporary landing strip built by field engineers. 6 other ATs landed around us. Above the brightness of the landing lights, I could see the deep black of the night sky.
Line them up!
Get a move on!
The platoon assembled quickly, forming ranks and standing at attention. Shannon inspected the line, then took his place at the head of the platoon. Captain McKay crossed the landing pad to inspect the platoon. Dressed in his Charlie service uniform, he looked cold and wet.
Report, Sergeant.
All accounted for, sir.
McKay pulled a digital map unit from his belt and showed it to Sergeant Shannon.
Secure areas 7J, 6J, and 5J. Then set up camp in the perimeter. Space W.
Aye, sir.
McKay returned the salute and walked off. The transports lifted from the landing pad. More would arrive shortly. Our drop zone was 22 miles out of Heroes Fall, a city with nearly 2 million residents that served as everything but the government seat for Ezra Cree. The locals called Heroes Fall the Old City because it was the planet's first settlement.
Okay, gentlemen, we have a long night ahead of us. Let's spread out. Harrison Lee, your fire team can take the flank.
Lee and I had 2 privates on the fire team, a grenadier named Amblin and a rifleman named Schultz. As the platoon divided into fire teams and formed a picket, we moved to the rear. We would remain to the right of the formation. When the shooting started, it would be our job to circle around the enemy. As we left the glare of the landing lights, the lenses in our visors switched automatically to night for day vision that illuminated the forest in eerie blue-white tones. While the lens enabled us to see clearly at night, it also rendered us colorblind and hampered our depth perception.
Keep the chatter down, gentlemen. Call out only if you see something.
The woods outside of Heroes Falls were filled with towering pines that reminded me of the grounds around my old orphanage.
Fan out. Keep an eye on your team.
About 40 minutes into our march, we located a paved road that ran through the woods, a highway leading to town.
Harris, over here.
I trotted to the front of the formation. Shannon had left the rest of the platoon and stood on a small ridge surrounded by a particularly dense growth of trees.
Harris, what do you see in that stand of trees?
Trees?
You ever patrol a wooded area?
Only as a cadet.
There's a trap door between those trees. See it?
No, Sergeant.
Stop looking for it. Listen for it. Use your sonar locator.
Using optical commands, I brought up the locator. A transparent green arc swished across my visor. In its wake, I saw 4 lines cut into the ground beneath a tree.
Come here, Harris.
Shannon walked toward the door. I followed.
It's called a snake shaft. You have any idea what it's used for?
No.
Neither does anybody else. They're what you might call an anomaly. Let's go in for a closer look.
Sergeant Shannon pulled a grenade from his belt and set it for low yield.
Fire in the hole!
When the steam cleared, I saw that he had blown a 10-foot hole in the top of the tunnel. I stepped in for a closer look.
Who builds these?
Mogats, I suppose. Nobody knows for sure. We found them during a battle in the Galactic Eye. That was the first time anybody saw them, I think. They can stretch on for miles, and they're strong. I've seen LG tanks park right up on top of one of these snake shafts and not dent the roof. We used to dare each other to hide in the shaft while a tank ran over it. As far as I know, no one ever died doing it.
Should we check it?
You want to go down in there? Me either. I'll have a tech send a probe through it later. Might be something down there. Sometimes they're rigged to blow up. I want you and Lee to go scout the area for more of them. Make me a map.
With that, Shannon returned to the platoon. It took several hours to scour the area. Our search turned up 11 more snake shafts. Lee and I caught up with the platoon at Heroes Fall. Captain McKay and Sergeant Shannon hailed us.
Harris, Lee, glad you could join us.
We just got here, Sergeant.
Across the camp, the platoons had already begun to assemble. I could see ranks forming.
Follow me.
We set up camp in a large meadow just outside of town. By that time, the rain and wind had stopped. The sun rose over the trees, and the wet grass sparkled. 3 Harriers and a civilian shuttle flew in from the west. The fighters formed a tight wedge and circled low in the air as the shuttle touched down. Once the shuttle landed, the fighters thundered over the city's edge and vanished behind a line of buildings. Captain McKay called the two platoons he commanded to attention. When we were in place, the shuttle's hatch opened. Out stepped Captain Oliveira, looking tall, gaunt, and dapper in his naval whites. Behind Oliveira came Vice Admiral Barry, the rather bell-shaped commander of the Scutum Crux fleet. Oliveira and Barry met with McKay at the bottom of the ramp, and the three of them held a brief conversation. A few moments later, another officer disembarked, one whom I had not expected to see. Wearing a white uniform that seemed tailored to fit his skeletal frame, Admiral Kleiber strode off the shuttle with what I would later learn was his distinctive long gait.
Let's have a look at the ranks, shall we?
He paid little attention to the rows of Marines as he walked by.
Have you encountered any resistance?
No, sir.
No one challenged the air wings either, Oliveira?
No, sir.
Have you found evidence of terrorist activity?
One of my platoons sighted a large tunnel west of town. It was over 3 miles long.
A 3 mile long snake shaft? Religious fanatics, mobsters, racial segregationists. It's getting hard to tell the riffraff apart. I understand the Mogats have a large presence on Ezekree. Are your men prepared to lay down the law?
Yes, sir.
And we have little to worry about, Captain. It seems like a very pleasant planet. Let's hope our stay is uneventful. Admiral Barry, I wish to conclude our tour of Ezekree within the month.
The name of the city appeared as Heroes Fall in our orders and in the media link accounts of our operation. But as usual, we were misinformed. The local signage said Heroes Fall, Hero being spelled with an I. Apparently, the city was named after Takahiro Yatagi, Hero for short, the planet administrator who stocked the planet with people of Japanese descent. This was the spot where he and the original colonists landed. In legend talk, they fell from the sky. Searching for riffraff in Hero's Fall proved to be problematic. The bureaucratic tangles began the first day. The mayor of Hero's Fall complained to Governor Yamashiro, and Yamashiro formally inquired of the Senate if the Unified Authority was declaring martial law on Ezekree. The historic reference did not go unnoticed. I wish we had declared martial law. I wish we had launched a full-scale invasion. Enemies do not demand their rights when you bully them. Citizens do. Several shopkeepers refused to allow us to inspect their businesses. The president of a car manufacturer called his congressman in D.C. when Captain McKay sent an inspection team to visit his plant. The Heroes Fall Police Department even arrested one of our fire teams for assaulting a local resident. None of this should have mattered, but the more we scratched the surface, the more we found evidence of deeply rooted corruption. An inspection of the Port Authority logs showed that the local police ignored smugglers. The Senate's problem might have been with the Japanese population of Ezekree, but the problem in this town was a Mogat infestation. I had read more than a few stories about Mogats since taking Alec Oberlin's advice about following current events. The Mogats were a religious cult that took its name from Morgan Atkins, a mysterious and charismatic man who had vanished about 50 years ago. I did not know anything about Atkins himself, and the only thing I knew about his movement was that it was the first religion created in space. Atkins' beliefs were pan-galactic. His preaching stressed independence, stopping just shy of outright rebellion. While the UA Constitution called for general freedom of religion, the Senate spun out a litany of obtuse laws designed to discourage Mogat expansion. The laws did not succeed. Protected by the courts, Mogat communes sprang like daisies across the frontier. News stories about the Mogat movement inevitably started with accusations about smuggling and ended with warnings about Mogat proselytizing and predictions that Atkinism would one day be the largest religion in the galaxy. We began sending routine patrols into the Mogat district the night after we landed. These patrols were uneventful. One thing I noticed during a patrol was that few people in the Mogat district were Japanese. 7 days after we landed on Ezekree, Staff Sergeant Ron Azor led the 25th Platoon into the Mogat district for a late morning patrol. The goal was to follow a random path, marching through alleys and small streets as well as main roads. Azor's path, however, was reckless. He opened his platoon up for an ambush by marching through a labyrinth of tall buildings and narrow alleyways. A four-story cinder block building lined their final stretch. Walking beside that building, Azor's platoon had no hope of spotting the enemy that watched from above. The platoon reached the middle of the block. Desperate to regroup, Azor shot the door off a warehouse. He and his men ducked in and radioed for assistance. Moments later, three rockets slammed into the warehouse. No one survived. The truck dropped us next to the pile of rubble that had once been a 30-foot-tall warehouse. We were the third platoon to arrive on the scene. Men in green armor dotted the rubble. Shannon led us to a corner of the ruins, and we began pulling up metal sheets and concrete chunks by hand. The tension was thick. Had a pedestrian carelessly strolled down the street, we might have shot first and asked questions later. But the streets were empty.
Dig. Any man who finds a survivor gets a 3-day pass.
We normally would have located the bodies by looking for signals from their helmets, but the heat of the explosion must have destroyed their equipment. There were no signals, so we dug blindly through concrete, iron, and dust. As time went on, hope dwindled, and the rescue effort became less organized. City engineers arrived on the scene with laser arcs that could cut through concrete and iron alike. With their help, we located 12 crushed bodies, and the search became even more discouraging. Judging by the way the bodies were laid out, Azor must have told his men to spread out along the outer wall once they entered the warehouse. Perhaps they thought that they needed to guard the windows and doors.
Fool! Clone idiot! The enemy shoots rockets at you, so what do? You don't hide in a fuel dump. God damn it! So much for passive force. Kleiber's gonna make an example of friggin' Ezer Kree.
What leads men to make such foolish decisions? Admiral Kleiber could never have touched the Mogats of Ezer Kree had they lain low, but they hadn't. With the Kamehameha at his command, Kleiber had more than enough firepower to overwhelm Ezer Kree, a planet with a commerce-based economy and impressive engineering facilities, but no standing army. Annihilating Ezer Kree was not enough for Kleiber. He wanted to use Ezer Kree to send a message across the territories, and he wanted to make that message clear enough that every colony in the Republic would understand it. The day of the massacre, the Kamehameha altered its orbit so that it flew over Heroes Fall. As it made its first pass, the ship opened fire, leveling the entire Mogat district. I did not recognize the scene when I hopped off the truck. The sun had not yet risen, and in the gray-blue light of my day-for-night lenses, the urban Mogat district looked like a desert. Lots that once held buildings now looked like rock gardens. We strolled around the wreckage for nearly an hour, not even pretending to search for survivors. Kleiber sent us so that the citizens of Heroes Fall would know that the UA Navy assumed responsibility for demolishing the offending district, and that the UA Navy felt no regret.
You see anything?
This is an improvement. If they planted some trees and built a pond, this could be a park.
By this time, the sun had started to rise above the skyline, and just as it cleared the tallest buildings, a motorcade approached. Four policemen on motorcycles led the way, followed by four shiny black limousines, with more motorcycles bringing up the rear. The convoy drove within 50 yards of us and stopped.
Local authorities, fall in behind the other platoons.
Moving at a brisk trot, we lined up in two rows behind the other platoon and stood at attention. The doors of the first government car swung open. I was not surprised to see Captain McKay, dressed in formal greens, emerge.
Attention!
I did not recognize the next man who climbed out of the car, but the third man out was Alan Smith, the mayor of Heroes Fall. A couple of young aides climbed out of the second car and joined Smith. As Smith looked up and down the scene, I saw a set of meaty fingers grip the sides of the car as the rotund form of Vice Admiral Absalom Barry, wearing whites with multiple rows of medals, got to his feet. Barry smiled as he looked over the landscape. Happy-looking wrinkles formed around his eyes. He approached the mayor, and the two men moved past our ranks.
I think a slight alteration in the town's name would be appropriate. Naming the town Heroes Fall. After the fallen Marines seems fitting, don't you think? And this spot, this destroyed area, would be a fine spot for a monument and a park, with a statue dedicated to the memory of the fallen. That would go a long way toward showing your loyalty to the Republic. Nothing too fancy, nothing over 100 feet, just a simple monument surrounded by...
As the others left, Captain McKay remained behind to address the men.
Gentlemen, you have just witnessed the Bryce Kleiber Urban Renewal Program.
Pulverizing the Mogat district changed the social climate for us in Heroes Fall. People who once pretended to ignore our presence now feared us. Captain Oliveira left 3 platoons to patrol Heroes Fall, then stationed the rest of us in other major cities. My platoon was assigned to accompany a diplomatic envoy visiting the capital city, Rising Sun. We crossed the planet in 2 ships. Most of the platoon traveled in the kettle of an AT. Vince Lee and I, and 4 other lucky privates, stood guard on the 2nd ship, a civilian cruiser on loan to the diplomatic corps. Wearing greens instead of armor, 2 privates and I stood guard around the main cabin. We stood like statues, pretending we did not notice as the bartender mixed drinks and the waiter served meals. Whenever I could, I stole a glimpse outside. The rain around Heroes Fall gave way to snow as we traveled north. We flew over snow-glazed forests and frozen lakes, heading east into a brilliant red sky sunset. The flaming horizon turned black, and we flew beneath a cloudless sky. As we continued on, the pilot lowered the lights in the cabin, and several of the passengers went to sleep. My detail passed without note, and I was relieved of my duty by Vince. After a few hours of sleep, I emerged from my small cabin into the craft's main cabin. I looked out a window and saw the first glimpse of dawn, a small swirl of light just beyond dark layers of mountains. And there was Rising Sun, the most glorious city I have ever seen. Rising Sun sat wedged between a snow-frosted mountain and a mirror-flat lake. Unlike Heroes Fall, a city that seemed to embrace the past, Rising Sun was thoroughly modern. The streets were regular and straight. White gold light blazed out of the buildings that lined those streets, illuminating the sidewalks. As we flew closer, I realized that the outer walls of the buildings were entirely transparent. The sight reminded me of a night sky filled with stars. As our pilot banked the ship and came around for a landing, I stole one last glance out the window and saw the lake. When we came to a stop, I peered through the window and saw the armored transport landing a few yards away. The hatch of our craft opened. Carrying my rifle poised across my chest, I led my soldiers down a ramp. We formed a line on each side of the ramp. A disorganized crowd of Ezra Cree politicians waited for our diplomats to deplane. The first man out of the shuttle was Bryce Kleiber, looking tall and gaunt, and wearing the same disingenuous smile that Vice Admiral Barry wore when he toured the Mogat district with the mayor of Heroes Fall. Yoshi Yamashiro, the governor of Ezra Cree, trotted out to meet Kleiber. Yamashiro was a stocky man with broad shoulders and huge hands. He was thick, not fat. There was no hint of softness in that neck or those shoulders. Kleiber and Yamashiro shook hands. Kleiber said something in a soft voice that I could not hear. Catching himself too late so that it would seem more awkward not to finish, Yamashiro bowed. He made several smaller bows as he and Kleiber waited for their limousine. When it pulled up, Lee and I followed, taking our places in the front seat of the car.
Admiral Kleiber, we are honored by your visit.
This is a remarkable city.
You are very kind.
As Kleiber spoke, his diplomatic corps clambered onto a bus. Once the lackeys were loaded, the entourage drove through town. The car drove us to the west side of town, where the Capitol building was framed by a backdrop of distant mountains. It looked like a glass pyramid with honey-colored light pouring out of its walls. There, we waited in the car while Shannon and his men lined up outside. Once the reception line was ready, aides opened the car doors and Yamashiro led us up the walk to the Capitol. Lee and I followed.
This building is stunning.
We are quite proud of our architecture.
I've never seen anything like it.
Then this is your first visit to Ezra Cree?
Yes. I thought I'd been all over this arm. I've been assigned here for several years now.
Low-level bureaucrats peered out of office doorways as we walked down the hall. For his part, Kleiber focused his attention on Governor Yamashiro. I saw several works of art around the Capitol, but the best piece sat behind the desk just outside the governor's door. She stood as we approached, and I had a hard time staring straight ahead.
Admiral Kleiber, this is my assistant, Miss Lyons.
I would have expected the governor to have a Japanese assistant, but this statuesque woman was cosmopolitan, with brown hair that poured over her shoulders and flawless white skin. She had green eyes, and her dark red lipstick stood out against her white skin. Admiral Kleiber paid no attention to her. He walked past Ms. Lyons as if she weren't there and into the office. She followed him, shuffling her feet quickly to keep up.
Can I get anything for you, Admiral Kleiber?
I'm quite fine.
We're fine for now, Nada.
Very well.
Yamashiro did not retreat behind his wide wooden desk. Kleiber sat in one of the two seats placed in front of the gubernatorial desk, and Yamashiro sat beside him.
Okay, Admiral Kleiber, the gloves are off. What can I do to prove my planet's loyalty to the Republic? We have the entire Ezekree police force searching for leads. I have authorized the wholesale questioning of anybody affiliated with the Atkins movement. A sizable percentage of our population, I might add, and you still have no proof that the Atkins believers were behind the attack.
I appreciate your efforts. All the same, I think the manhunt will go more smoothly if some of my forces help conduct it.
I see.
From what I have observed, Hero's Fall was overrun by Mogat sympathizers. I understand that several Mogats held posts in the city government. I'm sure you are aware of those problems, Governor Yamashiro.
I see. And you hold my office responsible for the attack?
Not at all. But I will hold you personally responsible for any future hostilities, just as the Joint Chiefs will hold me accountable for anything that happens to my men. I will insist, Governor, that you remain in the capital for the next few days. I've assigned one of my platoons to see to your protection.
Am I under house arrest, then?
Not at all. We're simply going to help you run your planet more efficiently.
Then this is undeclared martial
law. Martial law? Friends in the Senate warned me about your gift for historical references. This is not martial law, Governor Yamashiro. I'm trying to protect you.
Admiral Kleiber retained 5 men from our platoon to guard his quarters, then set the rest loose on Rising Sun.
Hey, Vince! The rest of the platoon is checking out bars on the west side of town. You want to go?
Those clones may be satisfied with mere watering holes. We shall look at finer establishments.
Asshole.
The bars we found were posh and elite, with swank names. Some had Japanese lettering in their signs. Men in business suits and women in fine dresses stopped in front of restaurant display cases to look at plasticized versions of the foods.
This looks pretty expensive. Yakisoba, whatever that is, cost $50.
Maybe that's the name of the waitress.
Pork tonkatsu cost $45. If pork tonkatsu is the name of a waitress, I don't want her.
How about over there?
Lee pointed to a small, brightly lit eatery.
That place is too bright for drinks.
I hated admitting defeat, but the Rising Sun waterfront beat me down. After a frustrating hour, Vince and I caught a taxi and retreated to the west end of town. As we explored the west end, we finally stumbled onto the trail of the kind of place we were looking for. We followed the sounds around a corner and found a crowded bar. Staring through the window, I saw several Marines. They had removed their helmets, which sat on the table. When I scanned the helmets, I recognized the name. I recognized the names from my platoon.
This must be the place.
I hope they have food.
Sitting in the center of this ungodly pack, happily waving a cigar as he spoke, was Master Gunnery Sergeant Tabor Shannon. One private placed his helmet over his head so he could read our identifiers as we entered.
It's Lee! And Harris!
The illustrious honor guard has finally found its way. Hello, Lee. Hello, Harris.
Sergeant?
I'll get the drinks this time.
I don't get it. Are we on duty or off?
On duty! Kleiber's using us as a diplomatic bargaining chip. He wants to show the locals how easy it would be for this visit to turn into a long-term occupation.
So, are we on our best behavior?
In this case, bad is good. Kleiber wants to show the respectable politicos of Rising Sun just how much they don't want us around. Oh, by the way, Harris, did you know you have a friend in town?
A friend?
Yeah! Appears the Japanese are not the only ones keeping their bloodlines pure on this rock.
Shannon turned and gazed toward the far side of the bar.
That guy was asking about you.
At the other end of the building, Ray Freeman sat with an untouched beer.
Know him?
I know him. His name is Ray Freeman. He's the mercenary I met on Gobi.
You would not believe how much they charge for a damn beer. For these prices,
Vince saw me staring at Freeman.
Friend of yours?
That's the mercenary that Admiral Brocia sent to Gobi.
Looks dangerous. Are you planning on talking to him?
He doesn't talk much, but I am curious about what he might have to say.
I'm coming with you.
You think he wants trouble?
If Ray Freeman came looking for trouble, I doubt I would have made it to the bar alive. He's worse than he looks.
I don't know how that could be, Harris. He looks pretty bad.
Freeman stood and smiled down on me as Lee and I walked over.
Well, hello, Wason.
Been a long time. How was life in the Corps?
What brings you to Scutum Crux?
Freeman sat down and waved to the empty chairs around his table.
I'm here on business.
Anybody we know, Mr.?
I'm sorry. Call me Ray.
Vince Lee.
I guess Wason has told you what I do.
Sounds as if you do it well, too. At least if everything Harris says is true.
I suspect Corporal Harris has exaggerated the story.
He might have. You're not drinking?
The head on Freeman's beer had gone flat.
Actually, I only bought the beer to help you blend in.
I don't think it's working. So is your target in the bar?
No. I came here looking for you. I heard your platoon was stationed in Rising Sun, and this seemed like the best place to watch for you.
What a coincidence. Both me and your target came to the same planet. Are you still looking for Crowley?
I have a score to settle, but that is not why I'm here. I bumped into another friend of yours from Gobi earlier today. In fact, he's staying in the hotel across the street.
Really? Who is it?
I was hoping to surprise the both of you. You know what would be funny? You and Vince can trade helmets and we can surprise the guy. You know, so you don't have that identifier? Just in case he's wearing his helmet.
That doesn't sound like such a good idea.
Nothing is going to happen to you, Wason. It'll be fun.
Who are we surprising?
You wouldn't want me to spoil the surprise.
I don't mind trading.
Tell you what, it's worth $20 to me to have you guys trade helmets.
I don't know about this.
You still don't trust me.
$20? What can it hurt?
Thanks. I'll pick up your next round, too.
Don't worry about it, Harris. I'll just head back with the rest of the platoon.
Lee grabbed my helmet, and I took his.
Look, Wason, I need to pay the check, so why don't you head across the street, and I'll meet you in the hotel lobby.
I took one last look at Lee, then put on his helmet. I got up from the bar and walked out. The lobby of the hotel was not as elegant as its outer facade. Poorly lit and cheaply decorated, it had metal furniture and a scuffed-up check-in desk. Freeman entered a few moments later.
Let's go.
So who are we here to see? Is it Crowley?
Not Crowley.
Rather than take the elevator, Freeman chose the stairs. We entered a dimly lit stairwell and climbed 12 flights.
You're still charming as ever.
As we reached the top, Freeman pulled his handheld computer from his pocket and looked at it.
Hurry. Your pals are getting ready to leave the bar.
We entered a red-carpeted hall with numbered doors. Freeman stopped under a hall light. He pulled a pistol from under his chest plate. He walked to room number 624. Pulling a key chip from his pocket, Freeman unlocked the door and let it slide open. We entered a suite. Freeman pointed toward a bedroom door, and I stole forward to peer inside. Someone was crouching beside the window, spying the street. I could only see his thick silhouette. In this dim light, he did not look human.
He's watching the bar door.
Using his right hand, the man brought up a rifle with a barrel-shaped scope.
He's looking for...
Then I understood. I sprang forward. The sniper turned around and started to raise his rifle. I grabbed the rifle, spun it over my right hand, and stabbed the butt into the assassin's face. I removed my helmet and went to the window. Raising the rifle, I looked down at the street through the scope. Most of the men from the platoon stood outside the door of the bar. The intelligent scope had an auto-action switch set to fire. The scope read the identifier signals from our helmets. The scope would locate a preset target, and the rifle would shoot automatically. In the center of the pack, Corporal Vincent Lee was clearly identified as Corporal Wason Harris, me.
You owe me $20, Harris.
The sniper reached up to touch his wounded face, and I noticed that his arm ended in a stub.
Well, hello, Klein.